You know, we take it for granted sometimes, don't we, that all of us nearly eat all the time whenever we want. Three square meals a day. We don't have problems like some other areas do. Now, of course, there are some people homeless that are desperate for food as well. I encountered that story last week in St. Louis when somebody ran out on his restaurant bill because he didn't have any money. He simply said he was hungry. Take this for example. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill deliberately let millions of Indians starve to death, according to an author of a book, claiming that he was motivated in part by racial hatred. As many as 3 million people died in Bengal in the famine there of 1943 after Japan captured neighboring Burma, a major source of rice products and imports. The British colonial rulers in India stockpiled food for soldiers and war workers. Panic buying of rice sent prices soaring, and distribution channels were wrecked when officials confiscated or destroyed most boats and carts in Bengal to stop them falling into enemy hands if Japan invaded. Rice suddenly became scarce in markets, worsening as hunger spread through villages, and Churchill apparently refused pleas for emergency food shipments. Emaciated masses drifted into an area where eyewitnesses described men fighting over foul scraps and skeletal mothers dying in the streets as British and middle-class Indians ate large meals in their clubs or at home. Can this happen now? Up next, Julian Cribb joins us with the coming famine. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. I'm holding in my hand an incredible story called The Coming Famine. Let me tell you about the author, Julian Cribb, the principal of Julian Cribb & Associates, specialist in science communication. He's the founding editor of Science Alert, the leading science news site of SciNews in Australia, Australia's specialist science media delivery service. And Julian is also a fellow of the Australian Academy of Technological Services and Engineering. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Noted author, by the way. Hi, Julian. How are you?
Very well, thanks, George. How are you?
Good. Glad to have you aboard here right now. And where do we have you? Where are you now?
I'm in Canberra, Australia, the national capital.
Isn't it amazing how we can go so far, distances? You're hours ahead of us now, aren't you? You're into...
Yes, indeed. It's late afternoon here in Australia.
All right. Well, here we are. The coming famine. You know, I right before you came on, it is true that we take it for granted that we eat just about anything we want in this country. Good food, bad food, doesn't matter. We can get it. We go to fast food places. There's an abundance of food for most people. Most people. Yet around this planet, it's a problem. And as you have pointed out in the coming famine, Julian, and I think so rightfully so, this could come home to roost. This can hit Australia, England, the United States with wars. It's a serious problem, and nobody's looking at it, are they?
Well, not really. I think we've taken our eye off the ball because, really, our farmers and our scientists have been so successful at raising food production in America, in Canada, in Australia, all around the world in the advanced economies, that we have become complacent about it and we have forgotten to renew the miracle, as it were, of food production. But right now, you know, bread prices in the supermarkets everywhere are going up because there's a drought in Russia, and rice prices in Asia and elsewhere have gone up because of the floods in Pakistan. So the world food setup is very closely interlinked now, and even a small blip somewhere immediately comes home to hit the consumer.
Now, your book, of course, is called The Coming Famine, which would scare the heck out of a lot of people. What do you mean by that?
Well, basically, I mean, if we don't reinvest in agriculture and reinvest particularly in agricultural science, and do a whole lot of other things as well, the world runs the risk of major famines starting in about 20, 30 years' time, but towards the middle part of the century, when we've got to carry 10 billion human beings for a period of about 30 or 40 years until we can get our numbers down, the world is going to have to sustain and feed something like 10 billion human beings, and many of them eating at much higher levels than they ate in the past. You've got China, you've got India, you've got these countries where people's animals, living standards are rising, their incomes are going up, and so they're able to buy more food, especially they want to buy meat and dairy and oil seeds and all the good things that we enjoy. So the demand for food is skyrocketing. It's going to more than double. But the things that we need to grow the food, the land, the water, the oil, the fertilizer, the technology, they're all winding down. They're getting more and more scarce, and there's deep reasons for that. And so, you know, if it was just a case of applying a bit more science, then we could probably do it. But it's not, because all of the basic things we need to grow food in the world are becoming very scarce now.
I probably won't see the famine. My kids probably will toward the tail end of their existence on this planet. Their children will definitely experience it, won't they?
Absolutely, but you never know. I mean, if there was a serious blip in the monsoon or something like that, we could see a famine next year. So these things are not, there's going to be no warning when it happens. And the other side of that is the gigantic cities we're building. We're building these enormous cities of 20, 30, and 40 million people. Now, a city like that very rarely has any internal food production. It relies on the trucks, a river of trucks coming every single day to deliver the food to that city. If there's a fuel shortage, if there's a small war and the trucks don't come, what happens to the inhabitants of that city? So those are the kinds of things that can spring up without warning, really.
And we see, Julian, what happens when a hurricane hits a city or a tornado or some other calamity. We're not talking about a countrywide problem. We're not talking about a worldwide catastrophe. We're talking about just little cities and how government can't even cope with that kind of a problem.
Yeah, we saw what happened in Haiti and things like that. Yes, we're quite unprepared. And so the book is a warning to prepare in advance before these things start to happen, before it really starts to come down. Because, you know, agriculture, you can't just crank a handle and double your food supply. It doesn't happen like that. It takes 20 years of R&D and solid investment by farmers and planning by farmers and food companies and things like that. This is a long, long process. It takes practically a generation to move a piece of technology from a university somewhere out onto thousands of farms. So we need to start thinking about it now, basically.
Explain to our audience, Julian, what it's like for someone to truly be hungry. You know, I know, for example, if you go a certain amount of hours before you eat, you get weak and, you get that pain in your stomach. Imagine not being able to have food at all because there's nothing out there. What happens to somebody?
Well, agony, basically. Agony for the individual. Perhaps what's even more important, though, is that if you get many, many people suffering, and the Spanish have this saying that there are only seven meals between civilization and anarchy. If the people go unfed for about 2.5 days,
good point.
They get very angry with their government and government's role. That's the point where governments are torn down. I mean, if there's a fuel crisis, people get angry enough with the government, but if there's a food crisis, people rip down the government. And we saw that happen in the French Revolution. We saw it happen in the Russian Revolution and the Civil War. And both of those killed hundreds of thousands, in the case of the Russians, millions of people. We have seen it constantly as a background factor in most of the wars that have happened in the last 20 or 30 years. You look at Darfur, it started with an argument between farmers and cowboys, basically. It was a disagreement over grazing. In Rwanda, the same sort of thing. In the background, there was an argument between different ethnic groups over access to food, land, and water. So these things are right at people's heart. If they can't feed their children, they get very, very angry, and they want to take or secure their food from whoever it is that they think is threatening it. It could be another ethnic group or another political group or something like that. But they're prepared to kill. So these things are a constant source of instability. And, you know, if you go on the CIA World Book site or you look at the defense writings from the British or the American defense establishments, they all acknowledge that famine is a major causative factor of wars. So the point is that if we don't have enough to eat or if we have short-term famines arising around the world becomes a very unstable place. Our children are a bit taken into harm's way to try to be peacemakers and things like that. It's a dicey situation if we don't attend to this food thing.
Where are the problem points right now, the pressure points, Julian, around this planet? of famine potentials, and it's going on in some spots.
Well, Africa is an obvious one because they didn't really enjoy the Green Revolution like other countries did. But, you know, if you look at the Indo-Gangetic Plains, that vast area of northern India, Central Asia, Western China that is watered from the Himalayas, as the glaciers in the Himalayas melt, the rivers which run year-round will become episodic rivers. They'll only run part of the year. And the farmers who used to grow two crops will only be able to grow one crop. And you've got 1.3 billion people there now and 2 billion people living there by the mid part of the century. Now, if their food supply is halved, you know, you've got a serious crisis on your hand. Let's look at the North China Plain, which is the food bowl of China. I mean, China is a very water-poor country. They have already used up the top aquifer. They use groundwater to grow their crops to a very large degree. And they've used up the top aquifer. They're halfway through the second aquifer. What are they going to do when the bottom one's empty? So, you know, these are big questions. Where are those Chinese going to go? What is China's response to that sort of thing? So these are problems not today, maybe not even in 10 years' time, but they're points of extreme vulnerability. And the thing we need to remember, let's think of the history of America and Australia and places like that. When the Irish famine was on in the 1850s, about 750,000 Irish died of hunger. But, you know, 2 million Irish packed their bags and left the country, and they went to America, and they went to Australia and Canada and other places. They just fled the country. That was a quarter of their population that fled the country. And the same sort of thing happened in Bangladesh in the 1970s. 10 million Bangladeshis packed their bags and went to live in India, caused a terrible ruckus at the time. So you see, you know, when people are hungry and they know there is somewhere else they can go to, they move. And that's the risk in this sort of thing. If we don't make plan for this, there will be these tidal movements of refugees going from one country to another. And that again is going to affect everybody, no matter how remote you think you are from the problem.
Julian, globalists will talk about population control, that they would love to see the world's population from 6.7 billion down to about 500 million. Your reaction to not how they would do it, which is probably going to be inhumane, but is it necessary? Is population control necessary? Is the reduction of this planet's population necessary to combat the possibility of the coming famine?
Yeah, there's a research group in the United States called the Global Footprint Network, and they basically say if everybody on the planet, all 10 billion of the people who will be there by 2060, if they all live like Americans, in other words, they all consume at the same rate that Americans and Australians and Canadians consume at, we're going to need four planets to support them. We're going to need... I mean, it's actually not a terribly difficult equation to work out. So something has got to happen in that space. We've either got to start recycling a lot of our stuff, you know, whatever it is, whether it's iron ore or coal or, you know, whatever it is. We've got to start reusing things in a way that we never did before, water in particular. So the question is, how many human beings should we have? Well, if they all have this high standard of living, then probably the Earth can really only support about 3 or 4 billion people. At the moment, the standards of living worldwide are much, much lower than they are in America,
right,
or Australia.
And we can't support 6.7 billion.
Well, we're having trouble. There's a billion of them who are hungry or starving today. We lose 15,000 children to hunger every single day of the year. So we're clearly not good at this at the moment.
So I truly believe that there's going to be some form of population control by groups eventually. We can't get away from it.
I think, you know, it's actually already happening. I'm not a believer in enforced population control. I don't think, as you say, those things are cruel if they're enforced on the population, mm-hmm. and they're anti-democratic and so on. But, you know, something strange is happening in the world today, and that is that young women, no matter what society they come from, what ethnic group, they are refusing to get married and they're refusing to have kids. And they are ignoring all the old men who are telling them to get married and have kids. So somehow or other, the female part, the young female part of the human race, is already responding. So it doesn't matter whether it's Mexico City or whether it's Shanghai or whether it's even parts of Africa. The women are having fewer babies. Fertility is falling. So the possibility of lowering the human race population voluntarily is increasing.
What's causing that? Education, or is there just some kind of mood around the world that they just say, you know what, we don't want any kids?
Look, no one has studied it, so I don't think anybody knows. But it's happening. It's a reality. I mean, Japanese girls are just completely out of the idea of marriage and kids. You know, young Australian girls aren't much interested in it. You know, I imagine it's the same in America. So what is motivating it? We know that when women have education and they have career opportunities and they have good health care for themselves and their children, they have less babies. We know that. But I suspect there's something happening at the species level too. I mean, this is a bit spooky, I know, but, you know, after World War II, we had a population boom, didn't we? Because the human race responded
right.
to the loss of all of those people, the tragic loss of all those people in the war, and we had the baby boom. And, you know, I'm a part of it myself. So at the species level, we responded to underpopulation back then, and I suspect that at the species level, we're responding to overpopulation now.
That's fascinating. And we know biologically, men are having difficult times breeding, you know, and that's happening because of environment.
Yeah, I think you also have to take into account the enormous amount of contamination and pollution in the Earth systems now.
Absolutely.
It's just everywhere. All the chemicals that we've manufactured in the last 150 years, many of them are toxic. They're probably having, in combination, a whole lot of untoward effects. But we know when you poison a laboratory animal, one of the first things to go is its fertility. So it's quite likely that we're poisoning ourselves. Yeah.
Frightening, isn't it?
Mm.
Truly frightening. Well, I want to talk with you when we come back after the break about the possibility of wars. You're getting some information from defense experts who talk and warn about food shortages. Tell me, Julian, how did you get on the topic, the coming famine? How did that happen?
Well, I've been an agricultural journalist for about 30 years. I'm interested in food production. And I just thought I would actually examine the question of whether we are able to sustain the food supply out till 2050. And I thought we probably could. Like a lot of people, I assumed it was going to be easy. And when I actually looked at the realities of it and the shortages that are looming of the things that we need to grow food, I began to have second thoughts.
Even if you're off by 50 years, we're going to have a catastrophe one day, aren't we?
There is a risk that there will be a large regional catastrophe in Asia somewhere, perhaps, or maybe Africa, and there will be this gigantic spillover effect to the rest of the world in the form of refugees and conflict and so forth.
Is the planet required, this is a ironic question, but is the planet required to help other sections? You know, is it one of those things where, you know, let's take care of ourselves before we take care of you?
Well, my argument is that this is a challenge at the species level. That this is the most important thing we face. It's more important than the global financial crisis, because that's only money, you know. You can survive without money, but you can't survive without food.
That's true.
And it's more urgent than climate change, because it's happening faster than climate change. Things are running out much quicker than the climate is changing, although climate change is a factor in it. So I'm saying it needs greater priority from governments and others. But yeah, it is a challenge to all of us, and I believe that the solution lies not just with governments and with farmers and scientists, but also with consumers. Consumers have to create a new diet for the world that is sustainable and healthy, but doesn't tread too heavily on the planet.
Let's see what happens between the worlds of the haves and the have-nots when we come back with Julian Cribb, author of The Coming Famine. Let's talk about what some defense experts are warning. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And for you Coast Insiders, potential Streamlink members as well, we're getting really close to the Android and BlackBerry apps. Really close. The digital folks have been working around the clock to get this going. Of course, you know, we already have the iPhone apps as well. If you want to sign up for just pennies a day to be a Coast Insider Streamlinker, just go to coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment as we continue talking with Julian Cribb about the coming famine right here on Coast to Coast AM. Julian, tell us, what are some of the defense experts saying? What are they warning about an impending food shortage and what it could lead to?
Well, there was a really interesting paper produced by the British Ministry of Defence 2 or 3 years ago, which actually it predicted the global financial meltdown. So it must have a few things right. They are basically saying that resource scarcities are going to be a primary driver in the conflicts of the 21st century. All kinds of resources, obviously, people may well fight over oil or diamonds and things like that, but they will also be fighting over food, land, and water. And if you actually look at the evidence, you know, if you draw a map of the world and you put a dot on it for every little war that there's been, you know, in the last 30 or 40 years, you will notice that those dots cluster in countries that are food insecure or where food is a critical element in that country's life. And the countries where food is plentiful, like the United States, like Europe, like Australia and so on, there aren't any wars. You know, so it's a really significant factor. There's this close nexus between conflict and people not having enough to eat. So the situation is that if we have these, you know, regional famines and things like that, the danger of conflict is magnified. The danger of governments being torn down by their angry people is magnified. The danger of us getting caught up in those things, our armed forces and things like that coming in as peacemakers, is magnified. So that's basically the picture that I'm getting from the defense agencies now.
And when we talk about war, it's not going to be just among little areas that are having famines. It will be major countries that are experiencing incredible problems, looking at other countries that have, and it's always been the case, Julian, it is the haves and the have-nots. And when you have that kind of disparity, you're going to have a problem.
You sure are, but food brings out, you know, if you like, the worst in us. A disparity in food makes us angrier than anything else.
Yes.
That you can think of. A disparity in BMWs probably doesn't matter so much, but a disparity where people are going, where your children are dying, then you are prepared to fight. And if you actually want to, you know, forecast which countries in the world are most likely to collapse governmentally into some sort of civil strife, you only have to look at childhood mortality and malnutrition. That is the clearest indicator whether a country is going to fall over. And if we saw that happening on a larger scale because we hadn't invested in agriculture and food security, then, you know, that's where it would really start to wash across the whole world, the global economy and so on.
Look, Fidel Castro had a reporter visit him a few days ago, and one of the things that he apparently said was the communist model for Cuba isn't working, and he's probably not too convinced it ever worked. And, you know, Cuba gives its residents about $20 a month and subsidizes them with free education and, you know, get their food and stuff, but they're not living high on the hog. So there's a lot of potential problems out there. How big a problem do you see China? Because they're the ones that would take if they had to.
Well, you know, there are two aspects to that. I mean, first of all, Deng Xiaoping was the guy who liberated China in a way from its communist thinking, and he opened up the free market. And the first place the free market operated was in agriculture in China, that farmers were able to sell their vegetables and their grain in the market instead of selling it to the state and getting a fixed price for it. Mm-hmm. And that was the foundation of the Chinese economic miracle. I mean, we're talking about 20, 30 years ago now, but that was where it all began. You know, this giant that is China today came out of freeing up agriculture, allowing farmers to trade, you know, allowing the markets to deliver a price signal to them and so on. So, I mean, communism has not been successful, and I think you could say in general terms, all isms, all ideologies tend to be bad for food production. It doesn't matter what ideology it is. Whereas you let things happen, you know, in a more natural way, then farmers are encouraged. But I've got to say, against that, farmers are getting discouraged at the moment by the globalized food signals they're getting, because there's huge concentration of market power in the supermarkets and food companies of the world, a very small number of them. And farmers are weak sellers because they're now competing with each other across the whole world. So a supermarket in England, for example, can buy its green beans from British farmers, but it can buy them from Kenyan farmers or Jamaican farmers or Greek farmers or anybody. So it, they use that power to drive the price down to the farmers. And I think this has caused a market failure in agriculture, which is part of the reason that we're not getting reinvestment and part of the reason that we're not producing, the food production isn't keeping pace with growth and demand.
What made the United States so strong agriculturally? And I mean, we seem to have the abundance of what we need. Why were we the lucky ones?
Because you've got a hell of a lot of very good soils, yep. For one thing, and you imported at the right time in your history a lot of very good farmers from Europe who were getting out from under from various religious or political persecutions, and America was the symbol of freedom, and you got the right sort of people, very, very hard-working people, people with fairly strong moral views and things like that. So, you know, that was it. But, you know, Canada also has had the same sort of thing. The migrant countries, the United States, Australia, Canada, have all benefited from this, and we are strong agriculturally. So that's what set us up. The problem now is that the world in the older continents and in Asia and places like that, the soils are being degraded, the water is being taken away from the farmers and given to the cities. You know, the price of oil is too much for farmers to afford to mechanize. They can't afford tractors. So you know, they're being held back. They haven't had the benefit of this agricultural miracle. And I would have to add as well, technology. Technology was at the cutting edge of the American farming miracle as it was here in Australia.
Have you ever been to the States?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Las Vegas at all?
No, I haven't been to Las Vegas. No. Mainly the farming area.
People are starting to move out of there, but originally they were moving in like crazy, and they're using up water faster than anything I've ever seen. And that's an example of just using it in you know, in an area that you don't have a lot of.
I understand that even the mighty Ogallala Aquifer that runs right down the middle of the United States is becoming depleted.
Yeah, it's going down.
And that story is being repeated, as I indicated earlier, in China. The North China Plain, which is their major wheat-growing area, is running through its groundwater at a frightening rate. Groundwater, actually, in every country in the world that uses it to grow food, is declining because we pull it out the ground at much faster rates than it gets into the ground. We very often don't know how quickly it gets into the ground. So we actually have no idea the scale of the resource and how long it takes to renew it. So we pull it out. We say a well is a free good, you know, we just plunder it. So we're mining our water all around the world at the moment, and that's a very, very serious thing.
Why aren't we building desalinization plants all over the coasts?
Well, I don't know about in the States, but in Australia, all of our big cities have started to do that.
Really? Okay, that's smart.
Yeah. I mean, it's good as long as those things are not powered by fossil fuels, that's fine. Because, you know, fossil fuels lead to climate change, and climate change is going to knock 10 to 20% off the world's food supply. So, you know, we've got to watch that one. But desalination is obviously an easy answer. But let me say this. Recycling is also an easy answer. Cities should not tip their wastewater into the oceans. They should clean it up and use it again, especially if they're taking it away from farmers. And this is a real tragedy. I mean, around Shanghai and China, I've seen all the rice farmers, you know, they sold up. They got a good price for their land. They've become city dwellers, and their water has been taken by the city. And there isn't enough water to grow rice in that region now. So, you know, you're seeing these kinds of things happening. If that trend continues and the cities continue to suck the farmers' water away, there is not going to be enough water. And the International Water Management Institute, which is probably the world's leading authority on this issue, their head, Colin Chartres, says we will not have enough water to feed the world in by 2030 if we don't do something about it.
Well, you know, what is so amazing about all of this is when this happens, and if nobody's made any plans to prevent it, it's not going to stop. It's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, the way I put it is that we have to teach our children to respect their water the way they respect liberty, because both of those two things are essential to our survival. And we're not doing that. You know, we still have a very casual attitude to water. We manage it extremely badly. We price it extremely badly. We price it like it's a free good in most places. You know, we don't know how much we've got, so we tend to overuse what we've got. And there are many things that have to change at that level. There are places that are water rich, like Africa, but the water is simply not being used effectively. So that's why they are hungry. But then there are places, as I say, like China and India, where the water is extremely overstressed. Central Asia is another one. North Africa is another one. You know, they're mining their water and it's going to run out.
Do you have this problem like we do, Julian, here in the United States, where after testing water, it's loaded with pharmaceuticals that, you know, people have had, they've excreted in, you know, they go right into the water source?
Well, we don't have that problem much in Australia because we gather our water inland and then we run it down to the cities. So it's gathered in an unpolluted area. But let me tell you, China has that problem in spades. I mean, something like 400 or 500 of China's biggest cities have heavily polluted water with not just pharmaceuticals, but industrial chemicals like you wouldn't want to think about.
Water wars. The CIA believes it'll happen.
Yeah, well, to some degree, they already have. I mean, there's been a Canadian study that charted, I think, 1,500 different water conflicts, you know, which range from harsh words to flying bullets. The Yom Kippur War, I'm told, between Israel and Syria was somewhat over the Litani River. So these things can be flashpoints in much larger disputes. So a shortage of water can be, you know, what lights the match, lights the gunpowder trail, as it were. And, you know, you're seeing now, very interestingly, Saudi Arabia, because it's run through its own fossil water, is now moving into farm in Africa, in places like Darfur, of all places. And so they're going to take the African water and turn it into food and take it back to Saudi Arabia. So there's this very strange kind of neo-colonial thing where countries are moving around the world, grabbing land and water as fast as they can go, because they realize it's going to be scarce.
What is the statistic about average person use of water a day?
Well, every single one of us uses about 3 tons of water in our food every day. So we drink, you know, about 3 liters of water, but we use 3,000 liters of water just for that hamburger, that coffee, that egg, you know, whatever it is that we ate. I mean, you would be astonished how much water goes into a simple piece of food. One slice of bread, 40 liters of water. I'm not sure how many U.S. gallons that is. It's probably about 10 U.S. gallons in one slice of bread. Pair of shoes, 8,000 liters of water.
That much?
That much, yeah, because that's the water that goes through the grass, you know, that feeds the animals that produce the leather or the milk or the meat. I mean, one kilo of beef is 15 tons of water.
So in some respects, we'll have water shortages in certain areas. In others, we get floods. We get too much water. So what do we do about that?
Yeah, well, and the floods are probably likely to increase in the wet part areas of the world, and the dry parts of the world are likely to dry out further. That's the grain belt, are likely to dry out further under climate change, so far as we can read what is happening at the moment. So that's a grim thing. That means that part of the American grain belt will gradually, over 100 years or so, migrate into Canada. Floods like Pakistan are going to increase, not only because you're going to get heavier downpours near the equator. Because you think about it, a warmer Earth, more water evaporates from the ocean. So there's more water in the sky. It's going to fall as rain. So you're going to get heavier rainfall, particularly around the equator and, again, in the further north and south areas. So you'll certainly get more flooding in the wet areas, and you'll get more drought in the dry areas. And that's a challenge if you're a farmer. It really is.
All right, tell us a little bit about peak land. What's our situation there?
Well, again, we've completely taken our eye off the ball. I mean, people were very concerned about land degradation about 20 or 30 years ago, but nothing very much has been done about it, except, again, in the advanced countries. There was a study in 1990 that said the world had lost about 15% of its farmland. The latest study, which was done 2 years ago, done from satellites looking at the Earth and working out which areas were green and what they were producing, estimates we have degraded 24% of the Earth's land surface. And we are degrading, and this is the magic number, 1% a year. Now, if you lose 1% of your productive land a year from here to 2060, now we're going to lose 3/4 of our land, and that's a very, very serious situation. You can't double world food production off 1/4 of the remaining land. That's just not possible. So this is an issue. And where's it going? Well, some of it's blowing away because it's badly managed. And, you know, so the lessons learned in the Dust Bowl of Oklahoma in the 30s have not been learned in the Mongolian desert, for example, and elsewhere in Central Asia and the Middle East. So that's one element. But the other element is the cities. The cities are devouring land like you wouldn't believe. By 2050, you add up the collective area of all of the world's cities will be a land area that's larger than China.
Jeez.
And those cities will have behind them a recreational catchment, which is the land that people use for golf courses and horse farms and recreation and things like that. That's going to equal the land area of the United States. So if you take that vast area out of agriculture, what's left? Only the kind of semi-desert areas, only the margins and the fringes where the climate is unreliable. So, I mean, all our cities are located in prime farming areas because they're all on rivers and they're all on the coast they're on the coast. So they're soaking up this wonderful soil and they're putting concrete and asphalt on it, and it'll never come back to grow food again because the values are not the values of agriculture. So, you know, this is a real concern. We need to start passing laws to stop this. And I'm proud to say that in Australia, one of our states, Queensland, did in fact pass a law just like that about a couple of months ago.
Well, and you know that with all this situation that is going on, that there's also that problem with oil, as you were mentioning. Now, I happen to believe in the abiotic oil theory. You don't, but I could be wrong. I mean, I'm not egotistical enough, Julian, to say, you know, I'm right, everybody else is wrong, in terms of how this planet has oil, how it created it, or how it was created. The point is, if I am wrong, we will run out of it, won't we?
Yeah, I mean, look, what I believe doesn't matter a hang. I'm merely going off what people like the International Energy Agency and indeed, you know, major geologists who've worked for oil companies say, and they don't say the oil is going to run out. It's not going to run out. It's just going to become more scarce and more expensive to extract. And so, you know, when that happens, if you're a farmer, that's a big problem because a lot of your operation depends on oil. And in fact, let me describe to you how much oil there is in your food. We each eat the distillate from 66 barrels of oil every year. So we are mostly made of oil in one sense, you know, this enormous energy that is required to produce our food. And that's just what's in the food itself. It doesn't account for the transport component or anything like that. So we really need the oil. And if the oil becomes scarce, and if, as certain American forecasters have said, the price went to $200 a barrel and $300 a barrel, and we saw it go to $160 only a couple of years ago, if it did that, then it would become unaffordable to most of the world's farmers. And that's the issue. That's the issue. So I'm saying now we need to seriously think about what is the new source of energy for agriculture so that the food supply doesn't collapse when the oil inevitably spikes. And there will be price spikes. We know that there are often price spikes in oil.
Julian, we're going to take this quick break. We're at the top of the hour. We'll be right back with you more as we talk about the coming famine on Coast to Coast AM.